I'm not sure it has ever really left me. Back home, my working life was feeling insecure. The world of forensic pathology was changing, and we were now threatened by new uncertainties of a sort the great Simpson never had to face. The university medical schools had always paid us to lecture in our subject, but they decided, almost all of them, one by one, that now they would not continue funding or teaching forensic pathology. The main reason they gave was lack of forensic research and lack of publication in prestigious scientific journals. However, we were too busy with postmortems and coroners and courts to meet these new benchmarks of a good university. The age of intellectual evaluation through research assessment exercise had arrived, and we forensic pathologists were found wanting. Gradually, medical schools with great traditions of forensic pathology closed down departments, and it wasn't long after Ian West's death that his kingdom at Guy's disappeared. St. George's hung on a bit longer, but my new department's warrant for execution had been signed. We had essentially been privatized. From now on, instead of providing forensic services for free, our salaries paid by the universities at which we taught, we would directly bill the police, coroners or defense solicitors for payment. I knew that without a salary, it would be hard to continue with some necessary but unpaid work. I'm talking about public work, like my ongoing contribution to teaching the authorities safe restraint methods, and my participation in disaster planning. Everyone else at the group was salaried by the police or some other organization. I no longer had the weight of a university behind me. Not only was the regular income gone, so were lectures and so were students, except at just a few specialist centres outside London. I had only ever lectured to packed halls and knew how interesting medical students found forensic work. I also felt that at least the rudiments of forensic medicine should be an important part of their training. Every doctor, no matter what their discipline, should be able to identify the signs of suspicious circumstances so that they would know when to call an expert or the police. But there was too much real medicine competing for too little space in the training schedules, and forensic pathology now became accessible only on specialist postgraduate courses at few universities. I set up a group called Forensic Pathology Services, widely known as FPS, through which pathologists in London and the southeast of the UK would operate in our brave new privatised world. And suddenly, while I was buried deep in its planning and organisation, I realised that I might not want to be a part of it. With a heavy heart, I had dropped Anna off that autumn at university. She had finally decided to study medicine. So they were gone now, both of our children, to the north of England. Of course they still needed us, but not in the same way. Our house seemed large and empty and quiet. Was that why we were spending more and more time on the Isle of Man? That home was nearer the children than London. Was it because, as my lectureship duties at St. George's were being wound down, there was little to keep us here? Was it because we loved our cottage on the island and wanted to support Jen's now widowed mother? Not that Maggie had let widowhood stand in the way of her social life, and in fact we're now, ourselves, becoming part of her whirl. Or was my work in London beginning to weary me? Weary me so much that even flying on Friday afternoons could not restore me. Every court appearance seemed to turn into a bruising scrap, and sometimes I felt I lacked the resilience to cope with it. There was no longer a bounce in my step when the police called me to another crime, another body. I had given up hope that they would ever phone me for my opinion on a case, and, looking into the future, I could see that pathologists eventually could be tendering for contracts, competing for bodies, even undercutting each other on price. Forensic pathology was a service, but no longer the intellectually rigorous world I had entered, with its scope for debate, study, and social change. Jen had become disillusioned with her work too. Despite her amazing feat in becoming a doctor so late in life, once she was practicing as a GP, she found she did not really want to be one. She had always been keen for us to move to the Isle of Man and believed that here she could practice her own specialization, dermatology, and live in the place she wanted to be. What else pushed us there? Our knowledge of our own senescence? A longing for the lifestyle Maggie and Austin had enjoyed? a hope that, if we spent more time isolated together on an island, somehow the loving communication which was missing would suddenly reappear. Perhaps I, and perhaps Jen too, was having that thing people call a midlife crisis, which no pathologist has ever been able to locate within the human body, not even under a microscope. But when I was asked to write the 12th edition of Simpson's Forensic Medicine, the 3rd edition of which you may remember had lured me into this profession, the invitation felt like a huge honour, and an excuse. So I was midwife too, but did not remain with the new forensic pathology services. Instead, Jen and I left London for good. We gave up the tidy hedges and neatly mown lawns of Surrey for a windswept and beautiful cottage on an island somewhere off Liverpool. I was generally believed by my colleagues and contemporaries to have completely lost my marbles. I was very happy and busy renovating the cottage. We went walking for miles over wild and windy moorland under big, big skies that were sometimes so clear we could see across the water to where the mountains of Mourne sweep down to the sea. We sat by the fire while gales whistled outside, or we just stared across the fields to the ocean as it conjured up dramatic storms from its depths. I did not carry out a single post-mortem. And here we had a social life. We had always been too busy for this before, but now we had friends. It mattered little that we were much younger than most of them. We simply slotted into the society that had been ready-made for us by Maggie. So what if she was aging a little now? She was still at every party, a woman with haute couture dresses bulging from every wardrobe in almost every bedroom in the house. Something delicious bubbling on the stove, a gin and tonic always at the ready, and she was never without an admiring circle of friends. It felt good to be among them, good to be part of a community. The children visited often. For me, there may have been no more postmortems, but there was lots of interesting work. I was writing my textbook on forensic pathology. I flew myself to the mainland to sit on committees for the British Association of Forensic Medicine, who were still sorting out Home Office contracts and many other details of the new privatised landscape. I was asked to give opinions on complex cases. I was busy on several ministerial working groups, devising and promoting more humane methods of restraint. Of course, I kept an eye on all interesting developments in my field. I learned that the police had reopened the inquiry into Rachel Nichol's murder. They now, finally, began to accept that someone other than Colin Stagg might have killed her. It took another 6 years for developments in DNA testing to nail Robert Napper for her death, the man who had murdered Samantha Bissett so violently and who was already detained in Broadmoor for life. I recalled carrying out the second post-mortem on Samantha Bissett's mutilated body, and I remembered saying to the detective how much I was reminded of Rachel Nichol's murder. I wished now that I hadn't simply made a passing remark, but said something more forceful, more questioning, more insistent. There was also a major development in the case of Sally Clark, the mother convicted of killing her 2 baby sons. She seemed to be planning a second appeal. She had been in jail for over 2 years now, but this appeal would be based on new evidence, new pathological evidence. The results of tests performed on blood and tissue samples taken from her second child had been discovered. The pathologist had not revealed this evidence before. In the view of some experts, but certainly not all, it showed that the second child might have died naturally of a bacterial staphylococcal infection. The Court of Appeal's job was to assess whether, if the jury had been in possession of this information at the time of the trial, it might reasonably have affected their decision to convict. The 3 judges decided that it might, and that therefore the conviction was unsafe. In 2003, Sally Clark, by that time a broken alcoholic, was released from jail. She died 4 years later. Sir Roy Meadow, the man who produced the extraordinary statistic that there was a 1 in 73 million chance of 2 children from the same family dying naturally, was publicly discredited. A number of the other mothers he had given evidence against and who were serving sentences now launched successful appeals. His maths was challenged by statisticians, and he was struck off by the General Medical Council. He later, much later, won his appeal against being struck off, but by then he was over 70. One piece of bad, off-the-cuff maths in court under intense cross-examination was a sad ending to a previously highly distinguished career. the pathologist, he who had examined both babies, changed his cause of death in one of them, and apparently withheld test results, was found guilty by the GMC of serious misconduct. He was suspended from carrying out Home Office postmortems for 18 months. David Southall had been a commentator on, rather than a direct participant in, the Clark brothers' case, but Sally Clark's release now catalyzed the inevitable backlash against his views and against the growing child protection movement. He may have furthered our understanding of the medical and moral complexities of infant mortality in general, and SIDS in particular, but angry pressure groups were formed by parents under suspicion and others who sympathized with them. And don't we all sympathize with the outrage of those who claim to have been unjustly accused? The groups complained to the GMC about Professor Southall. The GMC took their protests to its Medical Practitioners Tribunal service. He was judged unfit to practice and struck off. It took him many years and a Court of Appeal decision to overturn this verdict. His condemnation by the GMC received wide coverage. His subsequent complete exoneration went almost unreported. The Sally Clark case perhaps charts the history of our relationship with SIDS. Fashions in thinking should have no place in the world of scientific truth, but they certainly do. 10 years earlier, she would have been regarded as simply a tragic figure for losing two babies. By the time her first son died, SIDS was declining, but still a widely given cause of death. By the time her second son died, thinking had progressed further, and any pathologist in the land would take into account the full circumstances of the case. The cause of death actually given was that the baby had been shaken, and this reflected the topicality of shaken baby syndrome at that time. Overall, the case revealed our deep, new suspicion of mothers when their babies died suddenly. Her successful appeal may have reflected a public reconsideration of that level of suspicion. In fact, although the pathologist involved certainly made errors of recording and disclosure, the medical evidence was extremely complex and controversial, and huge numbers of experts lined up to disagree with each other in court on almost every aspect of both children's deaths. The truth in the Clark case, as in so many, proved to be not solid, but a rather unpredictable liquid. The courts wanted honesty and truth, and then chose to be selective and make their own assessments of highly complex medical issues. No one emerged unscathed from the tragedy of the Clark case. For forensic pathologists, it was certainly a horrible reminder of the huge responsibilities of our profession. Chapter 32. Much as I loved life on the Isle of Man, after a couple of years I began to miss the cut and thrust of day-to-day forensic pathology. I missed the camaraderie in the mortuary and at crime scenes, the sense of a close-knit team working together. I recalled the great humanity of all involved, while the startling evidence of cruel, murderous inhumanity lay before us. Committee work began to fill that gap. In particular, I was involved in producing guidelines to help the police and other authorities deal with a new challenge which was caused by the growing use of crack cocaine. This drug can produce an extraordinary mental state in some users, which makes them as strong as an ox and twice as dangerous. How to restrain these powerful, dangerous people to safeguard the public without actually killing them? Helping to solve this problem was worthwhile, good work, but it was not like solving a problem at the mortuary. Now, I always seemed to be once removed from the body, from the scene of the crime, from the coalface. Then, in 2004, I became engrossed in one of the most interesting and high-profile public inquiries underway at that time. It arose from events 7 years earlier and many miles away. I had not been a Home Office pathologist on call on the weekend of the 31st of August 1997. That fell to my colleague at St. George's, Rob Chapman. In the early hours of that morning, the Princess of Wales and Dodi Al-Fayed died in a road traffic accident in a Paris tunnel, he at the scene and she in hospital after an operation. The bodies were flown into RAF Northolt the same day, and the then coroner for West London, John Burton, who by chance also happened to be the coroner for the royal household, assumed responsibility for them. That evening, surrounded by high-level police officers, evidence officers, a crime scene manager, the coroner, Met police photographers and mortuary assistants, and with still more officers holding back the public outside, Rob carried out the postmortems in Fulham. Both had died from injuries sustained in the accident. The questions over those two deaths have never gone away. In a bid to stem the inevitable tide of conspiracy theories, a police inquiry was opened in 2004. It was led by Sir John Stevens, then Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, later Lord Stevens, and its aim was to establish whether or not there were grounds for treating the deaths as anything other than a road traffic accident. The new coroner to the Royal Household, Michael Burgess, suggested I act as a forensic pathologist to this inquiry. Of course, both bodies had been long buried, and so it was my job to review the evidence my colleagues had produced in 1997. There has famously been much speculation about the cause of the accident, but I don't think there is any doubt about the fact that Dodie and Diana left the back door of the Ritz in the hotel's Mercedes, driven by Henri Paul, and, crossing Paris at speed, pursued by photographers, their car hit the 13th concrete pillar in the Alma Tunnel at over 60 miles an hour. If a car comes to a dead stop after such an impact, unless restrained by seatbelts, the bodies of the people in the car don't stop with the vehicle. They continue forward and hit the windscreen, the dashboard, or the people in front of them. Diana and Dodie, in the back seats, were not wearing seatbelts, nor was the driver. He hit the steering wheel, and his injuries reflected that. But microseconds later, he was also hit from behind by Dodie, who was a big man, and who was still travelling at over 60 miles an hour. Henri Paul effectively acted as Dodie's airbag, and he died instantly. So did Dodie. Diana was slightly more fortunate because the Al-Fayed's bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones, was sitting on the right of the driver in front of her. Bodyguards don't usually wear seatbelts as they restrict movement, but evidently Rees-Jones, maybe because he was alarmed by Henri Paul's driving, or maybe because he realised an impact was likely, put on his belt at the last minute. Belts are designed to give gradually while they restrain, so he was held by the belt and partially padded by the car's airbag, which by now had inflated, as Diana's body catapulted forward from the back seat. She was much lighter than Dodie, and Rees-Jones's belt would have absorbed some of the extra force. This slightly lessened the energy of the impact for her, and so, more protected than Dodie, she actually suffered just a few broken bones and a small chest injury. Since Dodie Al-Fayed and Henri Paul were clearly dead when the ambulance arrived, the paramedics rightly turned to the injured. They did not recognise Diana, who was reported to have been talking. Trevor Rees-Jones had taken the double whammy of his own weight forcing him forward and Diana's weight hitting him from behind, and he seemed much more seriously hurt. Of course, he was therefore taken out first. Diana was anyway effectively trapped behind the front passenger seat until he was removed. Rees-Jones, as the more seriously injured party, was put in the first ambulance. Diana was then extracted from the car and taken to hospital as an emergency. No one knew that she had a tiny tear in a vein in one of her lungs. Anatomically, this site is hidden away, deep in the centre of the chest. Veins, of course, are not subject to the same high-pressure pumping as arteries. They bleed much more slowly. In fact, they bleed so slowly that identifying the problem is hard enough, and if it is identified, repairing it is even harder. To the ambulance services, she initially seemed injured but stable, particularly as she was able to communicate. While everyone focused on Rees-Jones, however, the vein was slowly bleeding into her chest. In the ambulance, she gradually lost consciousness. When she suffered a cardiac arrest, every effort was made to resuscitate her, and in hospital she went into surgery, where they did identify the problem and attempted to repair the vein. But sadly, by then it was too late. Her initial period of consciousness and initial survival after the accident is characteristic of a tear to a vital vein. Her specific injury is so rare that in my entire career I don't believe I've seen another. Diana's was a very small injury, but in the wrong place. Her death is a classic example of the way we say, after almost every death, if only. If only she had hit the seat at a slightly different angle. If only she had been thrown forward 10 miles an hour more slowly. If only she had been put in an ambulance immediately. But the biggest if only, in Diana's case, was within her own control, if only she had been wearing a seatbelt. Had she been restrained, she would probably have appeared in public 2 days later, with a black eye, perhaps a bit breathless from the fractured ribs, and with a broken arm in a sling. The pathology of her death is, I believe, indisputable. But around that tiny, fatal tear in a pulmonary vein are woven many other facts, some of which are sufficiently opaque to allow a multitude of theories to blossom. The conspiracy theorists, particularly Dodi's father, Mohammed Al-Fayed, believe the crash was no accident but had been arranged. The most widely held proposition is that the couple were killed because Diana was about to embarrass the British establishment by announcing a pregnancy. Since I did not carry out her postmortem myself, I cannot categorically say that she was not pregnant. Rob Chapman has been examined and cross-examined on this point, and he has explained that there was no indication of pregnancy. Bodily changes would have been detectable perhaps 2, but certainly 3 weeks after conception, even before she herself would have been aware of pregnancy. Some people have asked me whether Rob could have been persuaded to lie. The answer is an emphatic no. He would never dispense with the ingrained methods of a lifetime and agree to obscure the truth from a postmortem. And neither, for that matter, would I. The conspiracy theories, however, did not rest entirely on Diana's alleged pregnancy. Any number of reasons have been proposed to explain why the car crashed that night, and the theories have been fueled by the various anomalies of the case. First, there was the presence of a second car, a white Fiat Uno, which appears to have collided initially with the Ritz's Mercedes before the Mercedes hit the pillar. However, no one has ever discovered what happened because neither the car nor its driver, despite extensive searches throughout France and Europe, has ever been found. Then there is the anomaly concerning the chauffeur, Henri Paul. His blood samples revealed him to be drunk, but this was hotly disputed by his family and by some of those who were with him shortly before the crash. There were accusations that someone else's blood had replaced Paul's, partly because his sample contained traces of a drug used to treat intestinal worms in children. Paul had neither worms nor children. However, the drug is also commonly used to cut cocaine. Although Paul had clearly taken no cocaine, at least not that night, or even for a few days earlier. In addition, carbon monoxide levels were exceptionally, although not lethally, high in Paul's blood, and no one could satisfactorily explain that either. Rather unusually, Diana's body had been embalmed. A French undertaker arrived at the hospital to do this, and no one has ever really explained why he was called or by whom. Certainly not by the pathologist at the hospital in Paris. Probably the explanation is that embalming is a usual procedure for a member of the royal family. But since the bodies were flown immediately back to the UK, and Rob carried out postmortems within 24 hours of their deaths, there was no real need for the French to introduce preservation fluids into Diana's body. By doing so, they compromised all toxicology results. Some people saw this as suspicious action. But since neither Diana nor Dodi was driving, it is very hard to see what significance any toxicology from them would have had. After a lot of diplomatic wrangling, and armed with many questions, we, the police team and I, went to Paris. The French authorities did not greet us warmly, or even very helpfully, but we saw the crash site, and eventually even the car itself. Other specialists were trying to explain the carbon monoxide in Paul's blood, and they immediately began to examine the airbag, but my role, of course, took me to the mortuary. Here, I met Professor Dominique Lecomte, the charming pathologist who had the misfortune to be on duty that night. She had carried out the post-mortem on Henri Paul. She spoke good English until I started to discuss the post-mortem, and whether possible lapses in recording systems meant the blood samples could have belonged to anyone other than Henri Paul. At that point, she said little more and insisted on speaking only through an interpreter and often looked for advice to the lawyer who sat next to her. I hope she understood how much I sympathized and empathized with her. A routine Saturday night in a big city mortuary includes the odd road traffic accident, unlucky drunks, the victims of crime and brawls. In Paris, pathologists do not routinely deal with these over the weekend. They start performing their postmortems on Monday morning. Professor LeConte was therefore asleep at home in the middle of the night when she was dragged off into a situation of sudden and immense pressure. The world's most photographed face had died in a car crash, and her driver and boyfriend had also arrived at the mortuary. Outside, governments, family, and the international press were howling for the professor's conclusions. The general rule when presented with a high-profile death is to stop. Do everything slowly. Carry out all procedures correctly and in strict sequence. It is worth following these rules, because a celebrity death means that your every action will be questioned for a long time afterwards in public and in private. During the event itself, you are under pressure to get things done right now, in half the usual time and with half the usual information, to give simple answers immediately to complex medical questions. I have learned the hard way that no one says thank you in these cases, ever. The only comments that are made are critical. You either did something you shouldn't have done, or, more commonly, you failed to do something that, in retrospect, you possibly should have done. Unfortunately, pathologists in this situation sometimes do bow to the immense pressure placed on them to hurry, to cut corners, to accept the obvious. They do things out of sequence and may behave in an uncharacteristically haphazard way. I'm not suggesting that Professor LeConte carried out her postmortem haphazardly. I think she did a good job, and although I was later to uncover some errors, I have no criticism of her. And I can very well understand her defensiveness when a British pathologist arrived to ask insistent questions about how well she followed her own procedures after she was woken suddenly for a particularly demanding night's work 7 years earlier. The Stevens inquiry cost £4 million and resulted in a 900-page report, which was finally submitted at the end of 2006. It said, "Our conclusion is that, on all the evidence available at this time, there was no conspiracy to murder any of the occupants of the car. This was a tragic accident." The report did nothing to stop the conspiracy theorists, certainly not Mohammed Al-Fayed. In 2007, after much pressure, a full inquest was announced. I was called as an expert witness, and this time the French were finally persuaded to produce more of their files. I had already seen Henri Paul's full post-mortem report, of course. Then, in late September, very close to the start of the inquest, the French authorities finally released the post-mortem photos of Henri Paul. In 1997, police photographers used film cameras. The numbers on the negatives were reproduced on the back of the prints, and this meant it was possible easily to follow the sequence of the pictures that were taken in the mortuary. The first of the photographs clearly showed that Paul had been placed face down at the start of the examination. In pathology, you are taught to look at the whole of the microscope slide. There's always the chance of a tiny bit of cancer at one edge. The same rule applies to photographs. Ignore the blindingly obvious to begin with, and look at the background. So I looked at the background of the Paul photographs, and they showed a row of empty glass bottles, lined up and waiting for his blood samples on the sink beside the mortuary table, behind the body. Professor LeConte's report described a huge area of bleeding in the back of Paul's neck, probably caused by the impact from Dodie's body. Nothing unusual about that. But it was very odd that I could see more of the blood bottles filling with each sequential picture. There were a number that were evidently full before the body was turned over, ready for the chest and abdomen to be opened. That would have no great significance, except that, in her report, Professor LeConte states that the blood samples she submitted were taken from the heart, and not from the neck. Of course, she might first have taken samples from the neck as a precaution, and then discarded them when she turned the body over and found she was able to take cardiac samples instead. Cardiac samples are regarded as acceptable. In fact, femoral samples are the best. That would be good practice, but only if she recorded her actions. Or she may have labelled blood samples from the neck as being from the heart. It doesn't matter so much where the samples are taken from. Saying where they are taken from does matter. The site of sampling can significantly affect the toxicologist's interpretation of the results, and incorrect labelling can lead to great inaccuracies. You might take this as an oversight. You might take it as an indication of poor record keeping. But in a case like this, where every tiny event matters. It can give rise to many more questions about sampling sites, labeling of bottles and security of transfer. And it certainly fueled the accusations that these weren't Paul's blood samples anyway. Residual blood in the samples was tested and proved to be Henri Paul's. But that did not end the matter, because there were missing samples, spilt samples, samples that had been shared with other labs, leaving enough room for doubt for those who really wanted to raise questions. It was for the jury to decide the significance, if any, of the evidence I gave to the inquest. This was a large-scale affair, presided over by Lord Justice Scott Baker, who had been appointed coroner specifically to this inquest. He was represented by three barristers, Mohammed Al-Fayed by three. There were two for the Ritz Hotel in Paris, and two for the family of Henri Paul. In addition, the Metropolitan Police was represented by three barristers, and the Intelligence Service and Foreign Office by two. Other interested parties, including Diana's sons and her sister, also had lawyers at the inquest. Although, of course, there was considerable media attention at certain points, most days the lawyers heavily outnumbered the totality of both press and public. Questioning of the witnesses, as usual at an inquest, came first from the coroner's barrister, but there was often cross-examination from one or more of the others. Every tiny detail of that night and the months leading up to it was examined. My own contribution was minimal, but I think important to the outcome. I was asked what my overall impression of the events was. My conclusion? A simple, high-speed, alcohol-related road traffic accident. The jury's final verdict astonished no one and satisfied many. Unlawful killing, grossly negligent driving of the following vehicles and of the Mercedes. The crash was caused or contributed to by the speed and manner of driving of the Mercedes, the speed and manner of driving of the following vehicles, the impairment of the judgment of the driver of the Mercedes through alcohol. I wish that Professor LeConte had not been so resistant to Shepherd's charm offensive and had talked a little more. Her silence does mean that, pathologically speaking, there is a slight lack of clarity. But that doesn't mean I can credit conspiracy theories. I do not believe that what happened in the mortuary that mad night was part of a wider plan to murder a woman in such a haphazard way and then hide the evidence. Simply, Professor LeConte made small errors under pressure, which, in a case without so many seeking fodder for their theories, would not have been significant. I entirely concur with the jury's verdict. Chapter 33. In 2006, Tony Blair was still Prime Minister. There was a summer heat wave, and CSI was named the world's most popular TV program. Chris was almost a vet, and Anna halfway through medical school. On the Isle of Man, Simpson's Forensic Medicine, 12th edition, had been not just finished, but published. My pride in it was tempered by the sense of finality the book's completion gave me. Reading the third edition had started my career. Was the writing of the 12th edition a sign my career was ending? I still had plenty of work, sitting on committees, giving opinions on complex cases and evidence at public inquiries. But life was very different from that busy world I'd known before, a world that had at its centre a body. Demise unexplained, name perhaps unknown. Occasionally I began to experience a sense of ennui as I walked the hills with the dogs and stared at the sea. What was it? It took a while for me to recognise something I have barely experienced in the whole of my life, boredom. Or was it loneliness? I hardly knew what that was either. Alone together after some buzzing social event, Jen and I didn't seem to have much to say to each other. There was no need to discuss the children like we used to now they were grown, and the cottage renovations were finished, so there was nothing much to say about that either. Jen bought some sheep and started to learn how to manage her flock. I tried to develop an interest in sheep too, but the fact was, much as I loved our home overlooking the sea, it had begun to seem very silent. I even welcomed the noisy storms that banged on the windows and battered the roof, because they made the house feel so alive. When we moved to the island, we'd both thought there would be some part-time work there. Perhaps for me in the mortuary, and surely for Jen in a dermatology clinic. but this proved closed to us due to Ireland medical politics, and Jen ended up spending 1 week a month working at a clinic on the mainland. In 2006, I was offered forensic work as a weekend locum in Liverpool, and I took it. Maybe I had limped away from London to the Isle of Man feeling battered by my working life, by its politics, its administrative responsibilities, the interpersonal complexities of the new world of private pathology. Only now did I realize what I missed. The very heart of my work, that is, the dead and their mysteries. Standing in the Liverpool mortuary in my scrubs, with my PM40 sharp in my hand, I even felt renewed professional excitement for my first patient, one smelly and drunken knife victim who had been found in a rubbish chute. This was standby forensic work for the police, and I stayed in a hotel for 1 weekend a month in order to do it. Sometimes I was called out to a stream of homicides, and sometimes, to my great disappointment, nothing happened at all. I hadn't been away from hands-on work for long, just about 2 years, but we seemed to be in a new era of forensic pathology. The changes weren't dramatic, so much as a continuation of developments I had first begun to notice in London. Bodies were and are changing. Body fat has increased exponentially in the population, so that unless a patient is homeless, or has died of cancer, or is so old or poor they could not eat, few are the same shape as the dead of the 1980s when I started practicing. Looking back at forensic photos from that era, I'm astonished at how thinness was then the norm. Bodies also look different because they are so much more ornate. Once, tattoos were for fighting men and sailors. Now it seems that the majority of mortuary admissions have piercings or tattoos. In addition, self-harm was almost unknown then, and now I am amazed at the number of bodies, particularly the young, which arrive in the mortuary with old, self-inflicted cuts and lacerations. It tells me about their life and about changing society, but nothing about their death, the causes of which are generally not directly related to self-harm. For the pathologist in the 1980s, HIV and hepatitis were becoming the acknowledged enemy, and they still are. But by the time I returned to work from the Isle of Man, TB was an occupational hazard for anyone working in a mortuary, and I knew several pathologists and mortuary staff who had caught it. TB is much more prevalent than you would guess, and not uncommonly, even at post-mortem. We have no idea that we are about to be exposed to a highly infectious disease, which every other doctor has mistaken for a simple pneumonia. Post-mortem reports have changed too. When I started, 3 pages was considered adequate. When I returned, I was criticized for producing anything less than 10, and they were expected to be discursive, explaining the workings of the human body at length. Back in the 1990s, DNA started to make a significant contribution to forensic work, and forensic science soon overtook forensic pathology as the field's major contribution to crime cracking. Before I left, the police had begun to ask us to wear gloves at the scene of a crime. By the time I came back, it was gloves, boots, white Tyvek suit, hood up, and a face mask too. DNA analysis had become so much more sensitive that now we knew just breathing, just talking, sprays saliva with DNA everywhere. Gone are the days of the pathologist and senior investigating officer walking around the scene in their office clothes discussing the case. The white suits are certainly not designed for ease of dressing, nor for comfort, and it's always embarrassing to try to put one on when the world's press is filming you. But it is so good to take them off at the end of the scene examination and put them in an evidence bag. Yes, even the suits are kept for trace evidence now. In court, I had for years noticed how cases for the prosecution were becoming less meticulously researched and organized. Now, case conferences with counsel are a thing of the past. There is never a phone call, not from the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, or even counsel. If I am lucky, I'll get 10 minutes with the QC before I go into the witness box. More often, barristers don't have a clue what answers I'm going to give when they stand up and start to question me. Often they don't even allow me the chance to tell the jury who I am and why the years have particularly qualified me to discuss this subject. Dr. Shepherd, you're a registered medical practitioner. Tell me what you found on your examination of the body. The days of the thundering, bombastic QC were already ending when I left London. That defence QC who gave me such a hard time over the rent boys all over bruising was already a relic from the past, and now such barristers are almost completely gone. Presumably, for economic reasons, the Crown Prosecution Service seems to use junior barristers rather than much more expensive QCs. Of course, experienced, although not so overtly thundering QCs, are still out there, and they are nearly always working for the defence. Courts are much more interested in expert witnesses giving what is now called evidence-based testimony rather than experience-based, no matter how much experience we have. Judges have occasionally stopped me answering important questions fully, with a curt, "Just give us a yes or no, Dr. Shepherd," often when I'm responding to a long and detailed question from counsel. The essentially self-employed structure of forensic pathology in England and Wales that was introduced as I left London has removed almost completely the possibility of forensic research. Most of us do not now work or teach at universities. Forensic medicine no longer even has a place on the medical school curriculum. Research has anyway been effectively neutered by the Human Tissue Authority's insistence that families of the deceased give consent before samples, even minute samples, can be used for research purposes. How then, you may ask, can the answers we give to the courts be evidence-based? There will always be homicides and suicides and accidents, but now the routine forensic caseload will increasingly include negligence and safeguarding issues in nursing homes. It will certainly include a large number of deaths from drug overdose, and shamefully, there are many more deaths in custody, which speaks volumes about our jails. 316 in the year to March 2017, of which 97 were suicides. In the same year, there were in jails over 40,000 incidents of self-harm and over 26,000 assaults, and these figures are rising alarmingly year on year. The most shocking change I noticed on my return is that forensic pathologists are called to investigate a death less often. The cost and administration of opening an inquest seems to encourage some coroners to overlook an element of doubt. If there might be a natural cause, and a doctor might be willing to sign a form, many coroners will accept that without too much inquiry. Sadly, the need for the police to pay a standard fee, admittedly several thousand pounds, to a forensic pathologist, may be enough to persuade them that a death, especially, it sometimes seems, one close to the end of the financial year, really is not so suspicious after all, and can be dealt with by a local, non-forensic pathologist instead of one of the 40 or so specialists registered by the Home Office. Most people would agree that a civilized society should endeavor always to find, no matter what it costs, the true cause of death. The cost of the trials, the inquest and public inquiry into the death of Stephen Lawrence should serve to remind anyone in any doubt that it is far, far better and far, far cheaper to do all things properly at the start. I found that I enjoyed being back at the coalface in Liverpool, different though it looked. I was sometimes invited to lecture on the mainland by medical bodies or other professional groups, and I enjoyed that too. At the end of these lectures, interested people usually came forward to ask me questions. After one lecture in London, a forensic paediatrician chatted to me about my work. A forensic paediatrician can expect to see cases of child abuse, both physical and sexual, and this was, in fact, the paediatrician's specialization, not death, but the protection of the living. She asked me questions about bruising, and we agreed that, with our combined knowledge, we really should write an academic paper on the subject. Our work overlapped in that problem area between my research into whether a child had died naturally and her research into whether living siblings were in danger. And we met several times to discuss the paper on bruising during my subsequent trips to the mainland. On the Isle of Man, our house became more and more silent. Jen shepherded her flock. I studied my papers. One day she said, "We really ought to discuss our marriage." And I said, "What marriage? It hardly seems to exist." That was how it ended, one night in February, not with a bang, but a whimper, with little talk, but much pain, after 30 years. How quickly, in comparison to its length, the marriage unraveled. Perhaps every entity has a limited lifetime. Perhaps senescence is built into relationships, just as it is built into the human body. It seemed to me there was simply nothing left of this marriage of ours, but it was impossible to say this, to think it, without inflicting pain and engendering fury. There was the past, and there were two children, and a shared property, and that, of course, all had to be discussed, often acrimoniously, always with much pain on both sides. But we shared so little else that I was sure, when the shouting was over and the hurt receding, that better lives lay ahead for both of us. Jen issued papers to divorce me, and the process was complete within 1 year. It was not obvious to me at this time that I would fall in love with the forensic pediatrician I had been meeting to discuss our work on bruising, let alone that she would become my future wife. But I was never able to persuade Jen of my innocence in this. It was true I was spending time with someone whom I knew to be of special warmth, empathy and intelligence, but there had been no further planning on my part, nor on Linda's. She had been widowed when her three daughters were very small, and for some years now she had been in a relationship. That relationship and my marriage both ended with mess and fury. Despite her determination to divorce me, Jen suffered greatly. Our separation caused considerable unhappiness to our children too, who also, I think, wrongly suspected that I had simply found Linda and dumped Jen. Anna, almost a doctor herself now, during the period when her mother's pain was greatest and her anger red hot, declared that one thing she would never become is a pathologist like her father. I'm glad to say that Jen did find happiness with a new partner, and in September 2008, Linda and I were married. This added another family to mine, and I found myself back in the world of teenagers, as well as busy elderly parents. No matter how loving and welcoming a new family, relationships between each individual, between the two families, must be built slowly over years. We have applied ourselves to this, and the result, I hope, is a strong and loving extended unit. Since that time, I have lived and worked as a forensic pathologist in the north of England. Life here is rich and varied, stimulating work, a warm and loving home, interesting holidays, surprise expeditions, a shared aeroplane to fly, five children between us and, for me, two grandchildren now. My son Chris is a vet specializing in horses. He now lives abroad, where the landscapes and perhaps the mindscapes are wider. Anyway, he has certainly escaped poor pay and dark mornings. And he is following me in one way, by learning to fly. Anna is a consultant histopathologist, and yes, she does have a keen interest in post-mortem and forensic medicine, and even works for some of the coroners I worked for years ago. We chat often about cases. I seek her advice on newfangled tests, and she seeks my opinion on causes of death. She changed her name when she married, and no one can say that her father's name is connected in any way with her achievements. But probably no one would, because she is obviously very much her own person. Anna doesn't find herself torn between modern practice and a desire to be Keith Simpson. No, Anna's world is much more complex and accountable than the one I knew at her age. I see that world as less colourful, but she doesn't. She never knew Simpson's limitless horizons. I would say that my knowledge of death has helped me appreciate the importance of life's small pleasures, and I bask in them. A loved child running excitedly through a carpet of red and yellow fallen leaves, or tracing a finger with deep fascination along the wrinkles on my face. A fire ablaze while rain throws itself against the window. A dog hurtling towards me to welcome me home. A gentle hand placed lovingly on mine. I am no stranger to joy. I know that joy can be truly experienced only by those who have known adversity. And adversity is an inevitability. Chapter 34. One morning the phone rang, and an angry voice cried, "Have you read this crap, have you?" The voice was instantly recognizable as Ellie's. She is a pediatric pathologist with whom I'd worked on the occasional case. And the crap she was referring to? We'd together performed a post-mortem on a baby named Noah 18 months ago and given SIDS as the cause of death. I'd noticed there was something new about this case in my inbox, waiting to be opened. Ellie was unstoppable. How can we have missed lip injuries and fractures on the posterior ribs too? How? The lips were resuscitation injuries, or I'm Naomi Campbell. And we looked and didn't see any posterior rib fractures, and neither did the radiologist. How is it that this person can just look at the photographs and find suffocation injuries and old fractures? Tell me that, Dick. The parents of the late baby Noah now had another baby. Social services evidently felt there was enough doubt hanging over the earlier Sid's death to safeguard the new baby by removing her from the parents' care. Their application to do so was heading for the family court. Recently, the court had asked for copies of our report on baby Noah, our notes and the postmortem photographs, and evidently, all this had now been reviewed by another pathologist who specialized in working for that court. I clicked on the email. Yes, here were his comments. Ellie, he's surely not saying that we missed. He is. I'll look at the pictures and call you back. I felt sick. Was it possible that I had examined a dead baby who had been abused and murdered and failed to spot the evidence for this? And actually given SIDS, exonerating the parents and endangering any future babies they might have? And had the evidence been so obvious that 80 months later, another pathologist could pick it up just from the photographs? I dug out the file. Baby Noah was many cases ago. I tried to remember that day. I had been called to the mortuary by the police because the mother had found her baby dead in the morning. Waiting next to me in the lounge area next to the inevitable mortuary fish tank was Ellie. The postmortem of a child, whose death is suspicious, must be carried out by two pathologists, one forensic, one pediatric. Ellie is good to work with. Witty and wise, she demonstrates a 100% certainty about her own conclusions that I secretly envy. Now I flick through my notes. The mother gave baby Noah a bottle at 8 p.m. and, since he was sniffling, also some paracetamol. He went to sleep, but had woken twice in the night. The first time, at about 2 a.m, the father had rocked him back to sleep. The second time was at 5 a.m, and the father was waking up anyway, since he was on an early shift. He settled the baby and left the house at 6 a.m. without really waking the mother. At 7 a.m, she had found the baby dead. She ran, screaming, into the street. A neighbor who had seen resuscitation techniques demonstrated on EastEnders ran in and attempted to revive the baby until the ambulance crew arrived to take over, without success. Pictures of the home had shown the disorder one expects to find where there is a new baby. There was little furniture because the place was dominated by large plastic toys of the kind Grandma buys at Argos. The fridge was nearly empty except for milk and leftover takeaway cartons. Upstairs, the bedroom was almost filled by the bed and cot. There were piles of baby clothes on the remaining floor area. Most notable for us as pathologists was the temperature of the place. We saw pictures of the boiler thermostat downstairs set to 30 degrees. And pictures of the bedroom radiators on max. The police had commented on how hot the house was. There is, of course, a strong association between SIDS and overheated babies. Sometime after we had completed our post-mortem report, a number of anomalies and untruths emerged. Muslim neighbors were shocked to find their bins full of empty alcohol bottles and mentioned this to the police. There was parents later admitted that they had disposed of these bottles in the night. Toxicology extrapolated the father's blood alcohol level at the time the baby was supposed to have first woken at 200 milligrams per 100 milliliters, 2.5 times the drink drive limit. And the same test revealed that both parents had been smoking cannabis. The father had an old GBH conviction after a fight, but there was no history of domestic violence. The baby had an old shoulder injury, but this could easily have been caused by his very difficult birth. The police were clearly suspicious of this couple, but could not really articulate why, although they did find out that the house was so hot because there was a small cannabis farm in the loft. The ambulance crew strongly suggested that the baby had been dead for a few hours, not just one, as the mother insisted, but they weren't sure. And all the marks on baby Noah's body could be explained by the untrained resuscitation techniques of the neighbor and the subsequent prolonged attempts of the ambulance crew. Ellie and I had to agree on a cause of death. As the pediatric pathologist, She was going to write the report, and I would make any corrections and then sign it. Ellie was sure she knew what she wanted to say. Sid's, Dick, it's Sid's. But there's too much about it that's not quite right. I'd rather give unascertained. We're not here to pass judgment on them for having a few cannabis plants in the attic, for heaven's sake, or for liking a drink. They're obviously not a chaotic pair of addicts. The father has a regular job. The baby was healthy and well cared for. They turned up for all their health visitor appointments and vaccinations. There was a supportive, wider family, the grandma, the sister. No, don't let's leave unascertained hanging over a young couple who are simply poor and doing their best. Sid's it was then. Except now, another pathologist had looked at the postmortem pictures and decided it wasn't. I put the pictures up on the screen. Here were the baby's lips. They were redder than I remembered, and the marks on them were more prominent, but there was no swelling or bruising. These were injuries caused during resuscitation. I then looked for the serial pictures of the inside of the chest showing the baby's ribs. Sure enough, I could see some whitening in some areas which might indicate old fractures. Or was it just the glare from the photographer's flash? I phoned Ellie back. The lips look redder and more marked in these pictures than they really were, and there are actually some areas that look white on the back of the ribs. I could hear her exploding, so I went on quickly. We know that's not how it was. If you look at the pictures closely enough, you'll see some of the other organs are odd colours, and there seem to be flash reflections littering the images. It's the photos. Who took them? She roared. Who took these rubbish pictures? I remembered how Asako had stepped forward rather shyly with the camera. Had it been his first proper job? He had asked his senior for advice several times, and then the auxiliary flash had stopped working, and he eventually had to rely on the camera's own built-in flash. When I looked through the rest of the photos, I saw their quality was so poor that baby Noah's white nappy had a distinct blue hue. Why hadn't I noticed this earlier? Don't worry, Ellie, I said. It must just be a technical problem with the flash, and it's been made worse by the low resolution they've used to store the images. I'm not worried, she told me coolly. No, I'm very, very angry. This pathologist who's criticised us doesn't do postmortems himself, and he certainly wasn't present at this one. The other forensic pathologists who looked at the body on behalf of the family agreed with us, didn't they? How dare he challenge us when... Because, well, have you read the rest of the file yet? No, I have not. Because they've now found out all sorts of things about the parents, stuff they didn't know before, which gives a different picture. We thought they were young and struggling and trying to make ends meet with their little cannabis farm in the loft. But now it turns out that the father already had a baby with someone else, down south somewhere, about 4 years ago, and it died. Sid's was given as the cause of death. That silenced even Ellie for a moment. I said, it doesn't help that he's a former heroin addict who until quite recently had a methadone script. I wish they'd told us all that. Oh, go on, just victimize a man when he's doing his best to get clean. Was he on methadone when the baby died? No, there you are then. When he met the mother and had the baby, he was really trying to live a better life. That's how I read his police interviews. Exactly. And if we took every baby away from every recovering heroin addict, there wouldn't be any children left in some parts of town. Listen, Ellie, we'll go to court, give our evidence, explain that the photos are faulty, and we're sure the child did not have old fractures. Explain that the radiologist agrees with us, and that will be an end to it. It won't be so simple. We've given SIDS, and they don't want to hear that. I think they just want to take the next child away. It's quite clear they believe baby Noah was killed. Courts are briefed to find the truth, not what they want to hear. There was a loud noise halfway between a laugh and a snort, and then she was gone. The court case really didn't worry me. In fact, I was quite curious. The family courts have retained their mystery for me as for everyone else, because until now, only my written evidence had been used. These courts deal with such personal, sensitive issues that they are absolutely closed to press and public. No one without a direct reason to be there is admitted, not even close relatives of the deceased or their family. Ellie was waiting for me outside. She looked nervous. You should see how many people are in there. How? Virtually no one's allowed in apart from lawyers and witnesses. There are a trillion lawyers. The mother has a solicitor, a junior barrister and a QC. So does the father. So does the local authority. So does the new baby. Not 3 months old, and she already has three lawyers. So that's 12 of them for starters. Then there are loads of officials. Dick. Now they're cutting back legal aid for criminal cases. Lawyers must be into the family court